Hello and welcome to Crime Theories Off the Record, the podcast series where I talk about my interpretation of crime theories. This is your host, Karen. Hello everyone. I just wanted to bring awareness to May 5th, also known as Cinco de Mayo, not only as a day where my people celebrate the anniversary of Mexico's victory over the Second French Empire at the Battle of Puebla, but as a national day of awareness for missing and murdered indigenous people. You can join in honoring this cause by bringing awareness and wearing red or displaying a red dress outside of your home or workplace as we stand in solidarity with indigenous people and all those helping to end domestic violence. Moving on from labeling theory, it's important to note the distinctive focus on societal reaction succeeded in sensitizing criminologists to the critical insights that the response to it socially constructs the criminal nature of behavior and that a variety of factors can shape who becomes to bear a criminal label. The perspective also forced consideration of the possibility that state intervention can have the ironic, unanticipated consequence of causing the very conduct of lawlessness that is meant to suppress. However, what determines whether a label will stick? What determines the extent of which those labeled are punished? The nature of the labeling may depend on differences between those labeled and those doing the labeling. Whether labels can be made to stick and the extent to which those labeled can be punished may essentially depend on who has power. Theories that focus attention on struggles between individuals and or groups in terms of power differentials fall into the general category of conflict theory. But before I jump into this, I would like to remind everyone that I am not an expert in every aspect of my field, but I have researched the topic. Some conflict theories try to search for the sources of the apparent conflicts. Some seek to elucidate the basic principles by which conflict evolves. Others try to develop a theoretical foundation for eliminating the conflict. Still, others try to do all of this and more. Today, I will introduce you to some of the leading criminological conflict theories, beginning with conflict theory in general as found in the pioneering work of Marx and Engels, and eventually, if not next week, the work of Simmel. Off the record, conflict theory looks at society as a competition for limited resources. This perspective is a macro-level approach most identified with the writings of German philosopher and sociologist Karl Marx, who saw society as being made up of two classes, the bourgeoisie, aka the capitalists, and the proletariat, aka the workers, who must compete for social, material, and political resources such as food and housing, employment, education, and leisure time. Social institutions like government, education, and religion reflect this competition in their inherent inequalities and help maintain the unequal social structure. In the economic sphere, Marx focused on the mode of production, for example, the industrial factory, and the relations of production, such as unequal power between workers and factory owners. The bourgeoisie owns and controls the means of production, which leads to exploitation due to the profit motive. In this arrangement, proletarians have only their labor to sell and do not own or control capital. False consciousness is Marx's term for the proletarians' inability to see the real question positioned within the class system, a misrecognition that is complicated by the control that the bourgeoisie often exerts over the media outlets that disseminate and normalize information. These are just some of the structural constraints that prevent workers from joining together in what Marx called class consciousness, or a common group identity as exploited proletarians and potential revolutionaries. As briefly mentioned in early past episodes, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels were already expressing concern over the apparent decline in social solidarity by the middle of the 1800s, preceding Durkheim by several decades. For Marx and Engels, as well as for Durkheim, crime was, to some extent, a symptom of this decline and would diminish, although Durkheim made it clear that it never could disappear, if social solidarity could be regained. They differed in their analysis of the source of the erosion of solidarity and their prescription for its restoration. Durkheim saw the situation as a moral problem and argued that the social solidarity of the future could depend on an effective combination of controls through modes of social integration and social regulation that could operate in tune with the new division of labor created by industrialization. Marx and Engels saw the problem in economic terms, denounced the new division of work as the unjust exploitation of one social class by another, and insisted that social solidarity could be regained only with the overthrow of capitalism itself. In their view, the political state existed essentially as a mechanism for the perpetuation of capitalism, and it was deemed historically inevitable that the state would then wither away, leaving a society based on the true brotherhood and sisterhood of communism. Off the record, if this is giving Red Scare vibe, it is. For it is said that Marx himself had very little to say about crime. Those criminological theorists who cite him as a significant forerunner tend to extrapolate from his general approach to mention his collaborator Engels, more directly relevant writings on the assumption that Marx agreed, or to do both by citing Marx in general with specific quotations from Engels to nail down the point. Indeed, Marx and Engels stressed differences in interest and power much more than Durkheim. For them, conflict was inherent, like social arrangement under capitalism. For capitalism generated the vast differences in interest and capitalism that gave the few at the top so much power over the many at the bottom. Oh, well, that sounded like a tongue twister. Above all, their theoretical approach was action-oriented. They were less concerned with understanding social problems than changing things for what they considered the better. Although the work of Marx and Engels was highly complex, certain fundamental propositions stand out. First, there was a proposition that conflict of interest between different groups could be increased by inequality in the distribution of scarce resources, such as food, clothing, and shelter. A second proposition was that those receiving less of the needed resources would question the legitimacy of the arrangement as they become aware of the nature of the raw deal they were getting. The third proposition was that these groups could be more likely to organize and bring the conflict out into the open, after which there could be polarization and violence, leading to the redistribution of scarce resources so that everyone would share them. Overall, capitalism was considered to be at the root of the conflict because it was taken to be the source of unjust inequality. In this view, greater integration and regulation could perpetuate an unfair economic system. How to solve the problem of collapsing social solidarity was not to find some new sources of fate in the social order or some more effective means of regulating its members, but rather to destroy capitalism and build toward the one just form of social solidarity, communism. Thank you for listening and choosing this podcast. This episode is brought to you by Anchor. Please rate, review, and subscribe on Spotify or whatever platform you're listening from. And don't forget to tune in for the next episode. Off the record, if you need help visualizing these theories, go check us up on Instagram at ct.offtherecord.com.